go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! And here we go. I can happily report it is dry by my feet. The computers are apparently, it's solid wood, safe. Everything ain't fixed, but we're here. Not diggity. This is the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com for nearly 10 years. Delivering up something we call conversation radio. And I think most of us can say we've had a damn fine time in the process. Yes, yes, Marty, I threw the third switch. Everybody should be hearing this. The fact that you're hearing this gives me great hope. Right? Yeah. Now, the Head On Radio Network can be heard most easily by simply going to headonradionetwork.com and clicking Listen Live. You can also access it, however, on your mobile smartphone devices, streaming apps like TuneIn.com, Stitcher.com, Tuner Internet Radio. Now, if you spend a little bit for the I think the TuneIn app is free. You spend a little bit more for it, you can get the recorded version. Let me throw out there also that as we move into the future, for those of you who use smartphones, it would be a good thing to sign up and get the Progressive Voices app. That will come in right handy one of these days, I suspect. Now, I've got to do something real quick here because there it is. Okay, all good. Now, it's so depressing, the little noise that Skype makes when you sign out on a mobile device. Blip. But anyway, you can get those apps either for free or for a very small amount, and take the Horn with you. It can be ubiquitous. It can be just like terrestrial radio, because the future is going to be almost guaranteed to be without terrestrial radio, except for people who feel a burning desire to be told how to grow hair on their bald spots with herbal remedies that also produce erections. Right? Yeah. It is, of course, Tuesday. It is the... Hi. I'm Bob Kincaid. It's Tuesday, the 12th day of February, 2013. Notable for a number of reasons, and we have an absolute wealth right now of stuff with which to start the show. And we will get to it all. Just right now, I'm hopping into the Horn chat room.
Well, howdy!
Well, I didn't mean for that to happen. Who is that guy? Okay, let's make that go away before it happens again. Goodbye and hello. Oh, I hate this. This is not the time to say one of these days we'll rebuild the computer with a new operating system. Probably. But one of these days we will. We'll just... Sparky in the chat room, if you've got the power to do it, since I can't seem to turn the speaker off on, and I don't want to be playing howdy every time somebody comes into the room, could you? Is it too complicated for you to be able to kill the sound effects in the chat room for the time being? We'll bring them back one of these days. But right now, the Java's being persnickety with my operating system. And I'd hate to be playing a sound clip and hear me holler howdy. No, it is. It's Tuesday, the 12th day of February, 2013. And there's a number of places to go to get started tonight. Now, of course, the thing that everyone is talking about, which almost guarantees that we don't necessarily want to talk about, is the State of the Union address. And that's not because I'm not interested in government. It's because I recognize the essential nature of the dysfunction of our government right now. Barack Obama will say, let's just go to our buddy Ron in Raleigh for his analysis. Hey, Bob. The president will start his speech with the statement, "The State of the Union is strong." This is just one of the delusions that, if not addressed, will continue leading us down the path to destruction. The people of the United States are becoming increasingly poorer, less healthy, and less well-informed. There are two groups that are strong. They are the 1% and the military, while the children of the 99% fight the resource wars for the children of the 1%. Their parents are training foreign workers to do the jobs that are being sent to countries across the world. A presidential representative said on Tom Hartman's show today that we need to stay on top, and that expert thing, hey, I'm coming back to that, said that we need to stay on top and remain the strongest country on earth. This is another delusion that needs to be addressed. Our infrastructure is falling apart. Our educational system has fallen victim to a drive toward scientific illiteracy led by Christian fundamentalists. The only thing we have that is world-class is a military bristling with weapons of mass destruction, which is why we're in faraway countries that have no way of attacking the U.S., killing their citizens with impunity. We will continue to kill these people because there is no way to reasonably, in the minds of the warmongers, put an end to the violence. In the future, when the blowback comes, we'll stupidly ask, "Why do they hate us?" We are living in an armed madhouse led by people that can't see the massive harm we've done and are doing to people all over the globe. We do it all believing it's being done in the name of freedom and democracy. Delusion, hubris, and manifest destiny, the precursors to the end of empire. We're in the end of empire. We really are. That's something I've tried to reiterate time after time. Over the years, they don't put up blinking neon lights, empire ending, empire collapsing. Because, among other things, if you're running an empire, that's the last thing you want people thinking or realizing. Turn on the TV. Somebody's dancing. Keep your head down. Smart people will take care of stuff. Right? But Ron is right in what he says. And let's add to this the fact that there is no reason whatsoever. Look, the State of the Union discussion has been dominated by the fact that a draft-dodging, self-defecating, self-urinating, gas bag firearms fetishist is going to be in the audience. That's the number one topic of concern about the State of the Union. Oh, boy, I'm yelling already. The thing not being talked about, and Charlie Pierce on his blog today said, of course, those people he calls the gobshites will be wringing their hands about Barack Obama not saying enough about granny starving. And he's right. That'll be a topic of conversation. most of us, myself included, will probably tune in to hear Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, respond. And all he is, and all Marco Rubio is, who's delivering the, and he's the latest flavor over in the Republican Party. They'll be delivering responses of their own. Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, you must be awfully proud. You're filling the shoes that were filled before by Michelle Bachmann. One wonders if he, too, will refuse to look at the camera. But we'll be watching that because we like circus acts. Again, turn on the TV. Somebody's dancing. That's why we'll be watching. Right? Which brings me to the fact that historically there is no requirement that the President of the United States appear in front of Congress and deliver his address. Way up until, I think, either the late 19th century or early 20th, it was completely acceptable for the President of the United States to sit quietly home on a cold night in midwinter and send his speech down to the Congress where it would be read either by his designee or by the clerk because such conduct was deemed not befitting the office. And has there ever been a time in the history of the United States, in the history of this attempt at a republic, has there ever been a time when it is less seemly for the President of the United States to appear before the Congress than now? The President of the United States will visit the Congress in joint session assembled, where their idea of having a good time is to bring a guy who said, "Hey, Obama, you worthless piece of shit, suck on this," and held up a machine gun. That's the highlight. That is what Barack Obama is going to stoop to speak to tonight. Right? So, yeah, Ron and Raleigh's spot on. And then there's this. Rolled in a little bit ago, earlier today, actually, because they like to make sure that we've got all the stuff that we need for doing our radio shows. And I appreciate the impulse. But there is something that undergirds this that I find just a teensy-tiny bit distracting, disturbing. And I don't necessarily need to point out who sent it. Oh, come on. I want to actually... Among the right-wing pitches I received today, one, State of the Union. When will President Obama address the unborn? You want to hear some freak talk? Today, Susan B. Anthony lists President Marjorie Dannenfelser. I haven't been feeling good. I haven't been feeling very well lately. I think my Dannenfelser's inflamed. Marjorie Dannenfelser praised Arkansas Democratic Governor Mike Beebe. Is he Beebe or Beebe, Fritz? I don't know. For signing a bill to ban abortion coverage from the states and should... Monkey. Tonight, fling poo. Tonight we would like President Obama to name just one protection of the child in the womb he favors. They really do. They send this crap out. Proofreading, editing, dead, lost art. Just like understanding how the Egyptians moved the pyramids into position to build the blocks of stone into position to build the pyramids without giant laser cranes from space. just, we don't know. Editing. Tonight, because I want to read that sentence again. Tonight, we would like President Obama to name just one protection of the child in the womb he favors. May we presume that the womb he favors is Michelle Obama's? Somewhere out there, former journalists are cackling. In the great beyond, my mother and father are sitting in non-matching lazy boys across from each other saying, oh, we did! We taught the boy! And cackling merrily. Tonight, we would like President Obama to name just one protection of the child in the womb he favors. Is Michelle pregnant? And it goes on in the same sort of poo-flinging primate way for several paragraphs. But really, do we need to go any further? That pretty much takes care of things, doesn't it? But no, I'm... Damn it, where is this thing? No, it didn't come in. Because this bothered me when I read it. And I thought, well, I'm going to come back to that. Naturally, I can't find it. Oh wait, you want another giggle? Log Cabin Republicans issues statement. I would have thought that would have been Log Cabin Republicans issue statement. Damn, they haven't just given up on teaching science. They gave up on grammar, too. Why come you don't have tattoo? Dear Bob, tonight President Barack Obama will deliver his fifth State of the Union address. Blah, blah, blah. And then the Log Cabin Republicans issues the following. While we are happy to see same-sex couples in attendance at the State of the Union and the added benefits the military is extending to same-sex spouses, the one thing that unites all gay Americans is that we are living in the Obama economy and its burden of taxes and slow growth. If passed as prologue, the president's speech tonight is likely to lay out a plan that grows government at the expense of the American taxpayer. Oh, shut up. Go and change your armor. Oh, here it is. Here it is. I'm not going to mention the organization that sent this out, because I don't do this to demean them. I don't necessarily do it to demean anyone. Greetings. Knowing that many of you will be covering the State of the Union this week, I wanted to make sure you are aware that we have experts available to speak about it. That's all. I just spent all that time looking for that. We have experts available to speak about it. Now, just a few minutes ago, I read you a very, very erudite observation from our buddy Ron in Raleigh. Right? Yeah. Made sense. Very good sense. What is, and I'm processing on this because I didn't get all the way down to the ground with the thought when it struck me and when that irritated me earlier today. Why do we need experts? What is an expert? Any answers? Because I think we the people, because we're not teabaggers, And we don't think that Adam and Eve rode to church on a dinosaur. And we don't reject science wholesale out of hand. And we understand why a phrase like a child in the womb he favors is funny. Why do we need experts? Now, if you are trying to build a pyramid and you are trying to move stone blocks across a desert or through a jungle, you're going to need experts who can help you move the blocks without the technology of the aliens and their laser tractor beam. Because sometimes you just got to go it alone. Experts. Those are experts. Take the last log out from under the back and carry it lickety-split around to the front and keep rolling the rock. That's expertise. No, a little to the left. Okay, now we're aligned with the belt of Orion. That's expertise. There's lots of expertise out there. But to be told how and what to think about a speech? Really? Does talk radio need an expert for that? Or are we, lumpen proletariat that we are, sitting here munching away on our top ramen, are we capable of sorting some of this out for ourselves? Do we know crazy when we hear it? When, for instance, the Nuge hollers, "Hey, Obama, suck on this!" Are we not going to be able to figure out that that's deeply offensive and he should be carted away? Bueller? Anybody? This idea that we need a pundit for everything. I guess it kind of comes out of that fantastic old book, Flatland. Where there were it wasn't Flatland, it was Jonathan Swift, I'm sorry. One of Jonathan Swift's tales involved a visit to an island or a land where all the important people had people who walked around and flapped their jaws for them. They were flappers. This is that. We are so disconnected in this country that we have to rely on an official White House government spokesperson. When we know the difference between chicken shit and chicken salad all by ourselves. Experts, schmexperts. And so if there are those among you, perhaps new to the program, why doesn't he have any guests on? Why is it always just him and those people talking on the phone? Those are the experts. If you can get up at the beginning of a day and make it through the day and keep your power on and keep the water on and when the pipes fucking bone, you can go back and replace a busted pipe. If you can change a wall switch without electrocuting yourself. And at the same time, go online because, well, we know what the state of the print media are these days. And we damn sure know what TV media are, and there's practically no radio news at all. If you can do all those things and keep the family fed. If you can do those things and still be able to consider what your position is inside the republic, you, my friend, Jesus, you, brother, you, sister, are an expert. And don't let anybody tell you different. Because if they try to, they're selling something. I honest to God, I had to get that off my chest. There are more experts on this program on any given night than any right-wing radio show or any pundit on any other. Because you are experts. You get up every day and you carry this country on your back. We all do it collectively.
Now, he said collective. He must be one of those communists.
I've got a note coming up from our buddy Dr. John. And this kind of plays into it because in writing earlier today, Dr. John wrote a second time and said, by the way, I meant to write and say sorry about the pipes, you know, like you needed that. And I responded as follows. If we can't always prevent problems, but the beauty of this is when I respond, I get something even smarter back from Dr. John. If we can't always prevent problems, we can at least try to respond to them with some semblance of grace. Hemingway was a deeply flawed man, but what he wrote about grace was epiphanous. Sometimes a wry smile or even a ludicrous hoot, like, you know, when the water was, Houston! When the water was running across the floor, we have a problem! Sometimes a wry smile or even a ludicrous hoot coupled with some elbow grease speaks volumes about where we can be as a species. It isn't easily acquired, but that get-to-work attitude is, I suspect, much more to be found among us working folk than those who merely tug the bell rope for the help. We, after all, are they, the help. Poor, wealthy, hothouse flower bastards would starve to death without us. And that's the truth. You realize that. That's why they've got experts out there to tell you what to think and how to think and when to think it. Because the idea of you doing that, we doing that by ourselves and for ourselves and of ourselves, well, that's where the trouble starts. You know, we get uppity. They would. The 1% would starve to death without us. So we chuckle, sop, mop, and start carrying sodden crap away from Le Deluge. And like I said, I always get something smarter back from Dr. John. He said, you've got it. He said, and you, we do it all because of quote-unquote freedom. Freedom! Wolverines! I'm increasingly convinced that word is toxic. We're free to choose from a limited range of options, and the very act of choosing perpetuates the system itself. Bingo. Case in point, this. I got this from our buddy Michael. In Norway. Michael in Norway had written to me after the Sandy Hook massacre. Horrified. Deeply saddened. At the time, I had written back to Michael saying that if we in this country do not stop doing the things we're doing that are inhibiting the planet's ability to support human life. Well, what I said is, while the world weeps, we in this country desperately need the world to beg us to stop. No American should be able to step outside his door without hearing the collective cries of an entire world demanding that we stop. If we do not do that, a day will come when the world will stop us, and I rue that day. Which plays into something that Ron and Raleigh said. But last night, out of the blue, I got a response from Michael in Norway. And this goes to what Dr. John was saying about freedom! Wolverines! Michael said, with regards to the world begging America to stop, it seems to me that the world certainly is trying to respond in various forums online, but any input coming from any foreigner... No, I'm not going to play any music. ...seem to mostly be met with such utter contempt, particularly for some reason if the comments come from Europe. Any comments regarding weapons from a number of countries in Europe is pretty much met with a wall of utter contempt and profound ignorance. And he sent me along a little cut and paste of something from a posting he did at some website. He said, have a read of this, a snippet of a response to one of my own attempts at offering a perspective. I didn't actually suggest the United States is armed to the teeth, however, thusly it was interpreted. Yeah. And see, you can hear it. As I read the snippet, this is what comes of being spoon-fed information by so-called self-anointed experts. Because they are expert poor over on the right wing. I mean, they're swimming in them. Armed to the teeth. Have you seen the weapons Obama's guards carry? You are from Norway. What is with you foreign serfs? You are medieval trolls trying to drag a free nation down fuck off. Okay, let me put it simple for you. Gun laws will kill children. Maybe mine. Still want them?
Your children? No.
How many children do you want the ATF to kill? I will not give up my guns. I will not allow laws to stop me from handing down my guns, my father's guns, and my grandfather's guns to my sons. So you want to kill us? To save the children, you will kill them? Didn't a bunch of unarmed people, unarmed and people are capitalized, don't have time to sort that out, just get killed in Norway? A killer running around using bombs and guns to kill unarmed people and you think there isn't a reason to be armed? That is why you are a caveman. You don't put two and two together. Unarmed people are killed in mass as killers go room to room killing. I can't watch horror movies because people aren't armed.
Hairball.
The only reason Jason can kill people,
it's apparently real to him,
is because they aren't armed. They run away, that's capital R, capital A, like capital C, cavemen. It's not more guns, it's just better placement. Why should gun owners leave their gun at home? Or in a safe, for that matter? You are medieval.
I don't know if we're, I don't know, maybe you got that one right. You know, Blind Hog finds an acorn now and then. Medieval is capitalized.
You have a capital K king and no right to arms. You are living in the capital D, capital A, dark ages. The king has more say than you. That's T-H-E-N. That is why he has arms and you do not. Your brain is undeveloped.
Really? No.
You don't think about things as a, capital C, capital P, civilized person would. You think about things as a slave, naturally slave is not capitalized, as a slave would. Look how you talk about your land, it's not your land. It is the king's land. You are just allowed to live on it. The king has arms and you don't. The king has a, capital M, capital G, capital T, machine gun toting
bodyguard only because he doesn't want to carry his own weight, but you are not allowed to be armed. You do not have freedom. You have permission. You are a, naturally, no capitalization, serf. I am a, still no capitalization, citizen. You are a subject. I am a, capital F, Freeman. Morgan Freeman. You live in a, capital K, kingdom. I live in a, capital R, republic. There are, capital P, sort this one out, profound differences in our capital C culture. You have nowhere near, that's no W-E-R-E, near our capital I immigration rates. You have nowhere, W-E-R-E, near out gun ownership, capital G, capital O. And you have nowhere, capital N, near our capital F freedom, Wolverines! You are a closed society of not surprisingly uncapitalized serfs.
What did Dr. John say a minute ago about that word freedom? See, Norwegians aren't free. Pining for the fjords. They're not free. Swedes, not free. Germans, not free. French, not free. Brits, not... Oh, bad word. Bad word. Britons, Scots, Irish, not free. Spaniards, Portuguese, Italians. We'll leave the Greeks out of this equation for now. Not because I'm trying to ignore them, but they really aren't free. They are enthralled to the banksters. Oh, not free. No. Aussies, not free. Kiwis, not free. Japanese, sorry, not you either. Canadians, forget it. You're not free. Or if you are, it's only because, well, you know, you're close enough to us for us to be keeping you free enough to, for your corporations to go and rape the bejesus out of pristine forests in southern Ecuador. Staying. Michael closed saying, not taking such personally, of course, just so you know. I mostly had a big laugh at the bit about King Harold being all-powerful, apparently because his bodyguards are toting weapons around. Harold doesn't even vote. Wow. Just wow. What utter ignorance. Yes. Yes, it is. This in from Ron and Raleigh. Subject line, you knew this was coming. My friends, today on the EIB Network, we will analyze the nature of expertise, from whence it comes, and who gets to determine who is an expert. Yeah, I'm bringing that little Dominican boy over here. Yeah, ain't gonna happen. Whew. Mother McCree. So... Marty asks, didn't cavemen have clubs? By the way, this guy who's your voice, whose voice you're mimicking, apparently has never seen aliens, unarmed alien beings, kicking the snot out of very well-armed space marines. If you read that, remember, be snarky. Oh, God. But in no uncertain terms, we have an abundance to talk about, a wealth, as it were, and like I said, we just had a bunch of magnificent stuff come in overnight. Last night I was furniture kicking over the Titanic wit. It was more like Moran Monday, of the story that our buddy Jim told me about the genius over 35, 40 miles from here, explaining that Germany has more sunlight and that's why their solar program works better. That triggered a response from our buddy Scott in Sweden. The subject line was, as a geographer, which Scott incidentally is, as a geographer, I have to point out that annually, clouds and deep valleys excluded, the amount of sunlight hours is the same worldwide, whether it's Germany, Ecuador, the South Pole, and West Virginia, etc. What varies is the intensity due to the latitude and the amount of sunlight during the day. And then, see, this is reflected in that old truism that we can find easily in Shakespeare. Isn't it from Merchant of Venice? The rain of heaven falleth upon the just and the unjust. The quality of mercy is not strained, it falleth upon... Right. Same thing, apparently, if I understand Scott correctly, with sunlight. As a geographer, I have to point out that annually, clouds and deep valleys excluded, the amount of sunlight hours is the same worldwide, whether it's Germany, Ecuador, the South Pole, and West Virginia, etc. What varies is the intensity due to the latitude and the amount of sunlight during the day. At the equator, it is 12 hours every day, 365 days per year, while at each pole, although the total is the same, although less intense, and restricted to 182.5 days of each year, and is dark for the other 182.5 days, and for every place in between, the daylight varies seasonally and daily, with the greatest swings towards the pole, and decreasing towards absence of seasonal variation as one reaches the equator. Nonetheless, the annual total sunlight hours will always be the same at cloud top level. Oh, note to Ron, this ain't going to be on the EIB either. No. Now, writes Scott, as for photovoltaic cells, the more perpendicularly to the Earth's surface the sunlight strikes, and between the two tropics, Capricorn and Cancer, there are exactly 2 days annually in which it is exactly 90 degrees, the more efficiently the cells work. Naturally, one can angle the collector at any latitude to make it perpendicular, which is what Germans do, and minor daily latitudinal and diurnal adjustments would be best, but it is impractical, so they pick a useful mean angle. Still, the amount of atmosphere the sunlight must pass through matters, and the lower the sun is in the sky, the more air it must traverse, and this diffracts the light and weakens it, which is why far northern collectors cannot achieve the same efficacies as those closer to the tropics, and why collectors anywhere work best near noon and poorest near dawn and dusk. Now, as for our wingnut, Germany's total sunlight is the same as anyone else's, but the high yearly annual cloud cover, together with its northern latitude, makes for somewhat less potential usable energy than in, say, West Virginia, or Alabama. I'll add, or Kansas, or New York, or God knows, Nevada, or Arizona. Put those collectors in a lower mid-latitude desert, and conditions are fairly optimal. And that's why a new low-power loss grid is needed to get that power to the more humid, populated regions. End of Geography 102 lesson for the day. Sorry, but the record is best when kept straight. And to the extent I contribute to the non-linear straightness of the record, I apologize. I was merely repeating the ignorance. And there's probably a lesson in there for me somewhere. And for all of that, I think we can understand pretty clearly from Scott that our wingnut moran is, in fact, I'm looking for a couple of words here. Oh, yeah, wingnut moran. Green? Super green. Now, a note came in, and by the way, many thanks to Scott and to all of you who have continued to respond throughout from last night into this day to helping us right the ship. We caught up with January in what we did in the last couple of days. Now we have to keep on track with February. It's an ongoing chore, I realize it. But thank you so very much. I've got a bunch of thank you notes to get out, and I will. Patrick wrote from Germany, not about the sunlight issue. But Patrick listened to that acoustically dodgy show that I did from Washington, D.C. while having a bunch of problems, but did manage to get in Psychoticus's, what did he call it? A psychotic break with Psychoticus Rex. But he, but Patrick heard that in Germany, and he said, I just listened to the show, February 5th. Unfortunately, there were many interruptions due to bandwidth issues, but you read an email from a taxi driver and delivery person, and that email was pure genius. You hearing this, Psychoticus? I can attest to the fact that all of what he wrote is exactly the case. I worked for UPS up until last month, and I am glad to not have to deal with all that crap anymore. You remember Psychoticus talking about the pitfalls and perils of trying to find impossible-to-find locales? Right. UPS is a good employer, Patrick says, with decent pay, but the job itself was just awful. And now, this being note in from Dr. John, subject line, swooning. Bob, just for the record, Scott can talk geography to me all day, every day. I feel the same. Irish Dave with a question. He says, so does this mean we should not put our solar panels where the sun don't shine? Two. Also, too mathy. And you can't dance to it. Now, you know I have this... Do we have to say it? Do we have to say it with a good French accent? You know I have this penchant for history. And the beautiful thing about the internet is you can run off down the history rabbit hole just as easily as you can run off down the cute kitten picture rabbit hole. And wow, I did. And since this is Lincoln's birthday, it's kind of a Lincoln story. And there's a little bit of a backstory. And the backstory is this. Abraham Lincoln put together a cabinet that was referred to as, and Doris Kearns Goodwin chose the phrase as the title of her book, A Team of Rivals. There were brilliant men, venal men, and religiously insane men. Notice, all men who were part of that team. William Henry Seward thought that Lincoln, as did many, thought that Lincoln was a country bumpkin whom they would eventually manage. Had what was then a funny-sounding Western accent. Ran around telling simpleton tales all the time as a means of illustrating his ideas. Seward thought he could manage him. Seward quickly found out that he was dealing with a man of considerably more genius than he had given credit for. Simon Cameron was the first Secretary of War, and he was just a lost ball in high grass because his only purpose in life was to steal things. And I'm not talking about the silver. I'm talking about the entire federal budget. And then there was a man named Salmon P. Chase. Salmon P. Chase had been governor and senator from Ohio and desperately wanted to be the president. Lincoln, in part, put him on the cabinet so he could keep a close eye on him. Salmon P. Chase, in turn, had a daughter. Her name was Kate. She was known, and he, although religiously insane, made a point of educating Kate to the extent possible, as well as he would have educated a son, and that was a rarity in that day. On top of that, Kate Chase was stunningly beautiful. Her mother died early. She was raised almost exclusively by her father, for whom she was the sun, moon, and stars, and he to her. And she served as the role of hostess to the house in which he was set up shop as treasurer, the residence there. She decorated, but at the same time, she could also carry on a political discussion, a historic discussion, was fluent in Latin and Greek. But it was still a dysfunctional relationship, because she really had no idea of how a family worked, except for her family. And of course, it was a fairly wealthy family, and there were servants, and they were one percenters for their age. It may at least be said of Salmon P. Chase that he was a fierce abolitionist. He despised slavery. So he had that going for him. But he was religiously insane. And he had a monumental ego that told him that he was ever so much more intelligent than that bumpkin Lincoln. And that all he had to do was last 4 years in the Lincoln administration, and they, you know, eventually, then he would pursue the Republican nomination for president in 1864, and then they would start setting things to right, by God. Most of the Union generals, who wound up being complete disasters with the Army of the Potomac, were favorites of Salmon P. Chase's. But back to Kate Chase. If you look her up on Wikipedia, there are photographs of her, and you can tell that she was indeed, for her age, and perhaps in any age, a beauty. And she was courted as such. Salmon P. Chase, being Treasurer of the United States, was also always on the lookout. He was, after all, a man of faith, on the lookout for extra money. Eventually, it was engineered so that Kate would marry a man named Sprague, S-P-R-A-G-U-E, from Rhode Island. Raised his own Civil War military unit, outfitted him the works, got himself a commission in the state militia, and came dashing down to Washington, D.C. in search of glory. William Sprague the Fourth was his name. And he wound up marrying Kate Chase. William Sprague the Fourth turned out to have a little drinking problem. And then in the panic of 1873, a man who had been a multimillionaire was wiped out. Kate, by all appearances, really didn't know, for all the education she had had, she had been a child of privilege and was not quite capable or not quite able to deal with that sudden reversal of fortune. She also came into contact with an up-and-coming politician from New York by the name of Roscoe Conkling. And after Kate Chase's marriage to William Sprague IV went sideways, it went sideways in part because of his drinking and the financial reverses, and for his part went sideways because he found out that Kate was, as we say in the hills, a rompin' with Roscoe Conkling. To the point that what year was it? Let me see. It was somewhere around, it was in the 1870s. Conkling had been forbidden from coming onto the grounds of the Sprague estate, was found anyway. Some reports said jumped out of a window and was chased off the premises by William Sprague the Fourth, who had fetched his old Civil War musket for purposes of doing the chasing. Fascinating story. Can you imagine what Fox News or CNN would do with this today? This is American history. It really is that interesting, but I'm going to have to tell you. Kate Chase came to a sad and sorry end. She became, when they divorced, she got their three daughters in the divorce settlement, and William Sprague the Fourth got their son, William the Fifth, and was apparently such a successful father that William V blew his brains out when he was 25 years old. After the death of her only son, Kate Chase became more or less of a recluse, living in her father's, who had by then died, her father's estate that was known as Edgewood in Washington, D.C. Where she raised and slaughtered pigs and attended to the needs of, lived with her daughters, one of whom was disabled in some way. Back to Roscoe Conkling. Roscoe Conkling went on to have an ongoing, successful political relationship. And like Lincoln and like so many of his associates, it's Lincoln's birthday, so it's okay to talk about the good and the bad. The downside of Abraham Lincoln was that for all of his populist talk, some of which was sincerely held. He had also risen to the prominence he had achieved before the presidency that enabled him to pursue the presidency by virtue of being a railroad company lawyer. And if you were a railroad company lawyer in the 1850s in Illinois, or Appalachia for that matter, or just about anywhere else, being a railroad company lawyer largely consisted of screwing people out of their land. And from the railroads they came and to the railroads they returned. In 1881, Roscoe Conkling quit the Senate and went into law practice. He was, among other things, among the original drafters of the 14th Amendment. Or so he claimed. It was in 1886 that a case reached the Supreme Court called Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad. You will recall, of course, that the 14th Amendment extends the protections of the Bill of Rights, which had previously applied only to the federal government. It applied them to the states as well. All right? Roscoe Conkling, who had been the lover of the daughter of Abraham Lincoln's treasurer, went before the court and perjured himself. He claimed he had a diary entry relating to the drafting of the 14th Amendment, which he had noted that the drafters, in crafting the words of the 14th Amendment, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. He testified under oath that it was the intent of the drafters of the 14th Amendment, who were merely attending to issues that had concerned the Civil War and slavery. He claimed that that applied and that they had intended it to apply to corporations. It is now understood that Roscoe P. Conkling perjured himself in order to materially and financially benefit the railroad industry. And Union Pacific versus Santa Clara Railroad became the cornerstone upon which we later find ourselves dealing with something called Citizens United. Because in dictum, not even the this is the law part of the case, not even really in dictum, the Supreme Court clerk added a statement that corporations were people, persons, for purposes of the 14th Amendment. And thus I suppose we can say that Katie did not bar the door. So, just make a note. Every time you hear something about the further excesses of Citizens United, you can think of a man leaping out of the bedroom window of a formerly well-to-do Belle of Washington, running off into the night with her husband at his heels carrying a Civil War musket and running all the way to the railroad industry, where he turned fantasy into fact perjury into truth, and corporations into persons. And now you know the rest of the story. Irish Dave reminding me, he says, an old wobbly saying, better the government runs the railroads than the railroads run the government. Yeah, the wobblies lost, didn't they? Ray pointing out America was built on stealing people's land. Yes, it was. From the very beginning. Well, from the very beginning of the advent of white folks. Irish Dave also anticipated me just a little bit with an email says titled, also born on February 12th, Charles Darwin. Just a coincidence or something more sinister? Note capital letter. That's capital S sinister. Which brings us to a note I received from Dr. John called Darwin Day. Seems like everybody has a holiday now in this country except the people who are grounded in reality. I suggest February 12th. Dr. John writes, I'd like to wish you a happy Darwin Day. Today is the 204th anniversary of the birth of Charles Darwin, born 1809. I suggest that along with Freud and Marx, Darwin is responsible for a greater contribution to our understanding of the world and humanity's place in it, what it really means to be human, than any other figure in history. He was in his early 20s when he set off on the HMS Beagle for a 5-year around-the-world voyage to document the people and environments of the farthest-flung parts of the British Empire. Along the way, he saw slavery firsthand and came to hate it. He collected specimens of plants and animals, and he observed some of the immense variation in the natural world. Over almost 3 decades, he collected his thoughts, wrote books on botany and marine biology that are still cited, and developed a concept to explain the diversity of life. In 1859, he published the results of this, On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection. That last part is crucial. Natural selection means that traits that help an individual organism survive and reproduce in a particular environment will become more common over time. Given enough time, those traits come to dominate a population, and given even more time, they can result in a fundamentally different type of organism than the ancestor. Dr. John continues, it's stunningly simple and elegant. It requires that we assume nothing that cannot be observed in nature, and then takes that empirical base and extends it to explain everything. Remember, this was controversial, not because of the idea that species could change, that was obvious. Rather, because the mechanism of natural selection wasn't understood or accepted. Nobody else had connected the dots the way Darwin did. In fact, it wasn't until the 20th century that we knew how selection works. When we discovered how genes code for and transmit information. Darwin was writing about a force he didn't understand. He couldn't explain the mechanism, but he could predict it through its effects. I may be getting this wrong, but isn't that rather reminiscent of the way Newton sort of figured out gravity? It really does exist on that plane, or even a higher one, what he did. And it's one of those, that was me, not Dr. John. And it's one of those odd historical coincidences that February 12th, 1809 is the birth date for both Darwin and Abraham Lincoln. The two never met, never corresponded, and there's no evidence Lincoln knew or cared anything about Darwin. But Darwin was well aware of Lincoln. A little backstory first, Dr. John says. And consider that. Consider the differences between being born to, I guess, what we would refer to as the middle class in, what, pre or the early stages of the Industrial Revolution in Great Britain, and being born in a dirt-floored log cabin in Kentucky. And those two people on different continents of such disparate backgrounds, both in their own way managed to change the world. And both managed to be controversial to this day. Because people, A, don't understand, and B, do not wish to understand what either man was getting at. But back to the backstory. Dr. John says, right after Origin was published, Darwin needed support for his ideas from other men of science. Note that I use the term men advisedly. Thomas Henry Huxley was a key ally in Britain. He called himself Darwin's bulldog and was known to debate scientists and archbishops alike in Darwin's defense. In the U.S., Asa Gray was Darwin's man. Gray was the most prominent American botanist of the middle 19th century, a science superstar. Under Gray's advocacy, Darwin's ideas took hold among American men of science. Here's where Darwin and Lincoln overlap. Gray was a devout Christian, anti-slavery, and rejected the dominant idea of how different, quote-unquote, races, because we understand that to be an utterly BS term, came to be different. The dominant theory was called polygenesis. Well, it sounds scientific. It wasn't. God created multiple species of humans and gave them unique abilities. Hence, some people were naturally meant to serve others. Three guesses which race was on top and which was on the bottom. White folks were on top and everybody else was on the bottom. Gray, essentially alone among mid-19th century American scientists, said that was rubbish. Gray developed a long correspondence with Darwin. Even before Origin was published, Darwin would run ideas past Gray, and Gray's botanical studies influenced his own work. Darwin had seen slavery firsthand in Brazil and was scarred by it for the rest of his life. Gray wrote Darwin after the Emancipation Proclamation was issued. Darwin replied that he was afraid it would lead to rebellion in the North, thus the South's victory in perpetual slavery. He then said he hoped his prophecies would be, quote, as utterly wrong as most of my other prophecies have been, unquote, and that the, quote, cruel evil to the whole world would pass. Upon hearing of the fall of Richmond, Darwin wrote to Gray, one thing I have always thought was that the destruction of slavery would be well worth a dozen years' war. And he was distressed by the news of Lincoln's assassination. It wasn't until 1871 in The Descent of Man that Darwin turned to evolution and humans. A primary goal here was to smash the polygenists and other racist theories of human variation. Darwin shows that differences in human populations are literally skin deep, the result of adaptations to different environments, just like any other animal. You really can't express how important Darwin is, mainly in terms of science, but also in terms of culture. Darwin shows that race isn't biological. He demonstrates a critical link between environments and organisms. That's hugely significant in terms of human-caused changes to our surroundings. Everything from farm runoff to carbon increases to toxins from mountaintop removal can harm us much faster than we're able to adapt to it. And even more sinister, all organisms are affected by natural selection and the other forces of evolution, including pathogens. Bacteria evolve much faster than we do simply because they reproduce more quickly. That means they can develop resistances to antibiotics through exposure. They can become more virulent and harder to kill if their own environment is more toxic. Then when humans encounter them, we can't fight them off. Understanding natural selection also shows what's wrong when people try to apply evolutionary principles to human cultures. Ever hear of survival of the fittest? Yeah, that's not Darwin. It was coined by a nasty 19th century right-winger named Herbert Spencer. Any kin to the Spencers who later produced The Fair Diana, he wondered to himself. Would make sense, wouldn't it? That doctrine, survival of the fittest, fundamentally at odds with what Darwin was talking about, crops up every so often to justify war, racism, oppression. It runs deeply through basically every conservative stance on social policy. Let the fill-in-the-blank group improve themselves. We don't owe them anything. Competition is the law of nature. You've heard it. And so on. All false and not predicted or justified by natural selection, as people like Huxley took pains to explain. And so John closes saying, I know we're all captivated by the Pope and by the State of the Union and all the thousand things that arise any day, but it's worth spending a little time thinking about this long-dead man and how he developed an idea that's so elegant, so simple, and yet has shaken the world so much. And the shaking, I will add, persists to this day. For while we may have a laugh at the expense of a right-wing moron who writes as the one did to in the letter to Michael from Norway, there is no single better determinant of ignorance than when you hear an individual say, I don't believe in that Charles Darwin. For in that moment, you know you are dealing with either ignorance of the willful variety, ignorance of the lack of education variety, outright stupidity, or some combination of stupidity and ignorance. There's no other explanation. There used to be an old thing that went around, a joke that you could ask you could tell all you needed to know about someone's personality by asking them who their favorite Beatle was. That depending on whether they said George, John, Paul, or Ringo, you would have some idea of how their mind worked. Far more likely, however, is that you will learn practically everything you need to know about a human being by simply asking, or not even asking, but uttering those two little names, Charles and Darwin. And before even the first word is said, if a cloud comes across the face of the person that you're speaking to, if they draw in a deep breath as if to begin some sort of a fight or a struggle, or if they snort or roll their eyes, you know in that moment that you are in the presence of manifest ignorance and or stupidity. So yes, indeed, thank you, Dr. John, and a very happy Darwin Day to us all. Someday, if this country can survive, perhaps we can have a giant monument as big as the Einstein statue in Washington, D.C., to Charles Darwin. You want to just administer a giant IQ test to the entire country? Propose that monument now. For all its magical power to transform right-wingers into howling zealots, they will completely forget about Agenda 21. And the next dozen elections, or election cycles, will instead be decided upon whether to build that Darwin monument. And we'll have a pretty good idea right quick of just how bad off this country is. It's kind of like a stress test for your heart, you know, with the treadmill and everything, where you deliberately work the heart and you deliberately work the circulatory system, the pulmonary system, to find out how much stress it can take. Hopefully without inducing a heart attack. Well, that's exactly what a Darwin monument in the United States would be. You know, a big splashy one on the National Mall. Or somewhere near it. It would be a stress test for this country. And stress tests have a way of being pass-fail. Right? So that is where we find ourselves almost halfway into tonight's program. That's tonight's filibobster. It's about 24 minutes past the hour. And we're going to take a little break. And we'll come back and hopefully do the conversation radio side of, well, conversation radio. The lines are open, 304-658-3333. And, in fact, the Skype lines are also open. Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn. That's the handle for getting in touch with the program on Skype. If we're not friends yet, shoot me a request, and, well, I'll add you to the contact list. Let's do that. It is Tuesday. It is the 12th of February, 2013. We have an installment of the Green News Report coming your way. Conversation Radio on the Horn is listener-supported. And you've done a magnificent job of supporting in the last couple of days. And thanks go out to everyone. Everyone. Bumper music this evening, courtesy of Ron and Raleigh. Australia. Oh, that, okay, cold open, so let's get that right. This is the Horn.
Ah, the quality of mercy is not strain, y'all.
All right.
Now. I'll show you how it goes, all right?
Come on.
We think the solid music. Quality of mercy. The quality of mercy.
The quality of mercy.
The quality of mercy.
Quality of mercy.
The quality of mercy.
All right, but that's not very dark, right? All right, I'll let you know when that comes in.
All you hypocrites and liars in the temple seeking gain. All you senators and lawyers with your motives to explain. All you victims and you heroes, your petitions to complain. All you murderers, you martyrs on the field where you lay. On the just and unjust, yes, like it does rain. And the quality of mercy is not strange. Yeah, vengeance and revenge are just two words for pain. Yeah. And the quality of mercy is not strange.
Tuesday, February 12, 2013.
Ad punitionem certam pervenit.
And now let us entrust the Holy Church to the care of our Supreme Pastor.
Too pooped to Pope. Pope Benedict's green legacy.
Winter Storm Nemo.
Did global warming find Nemo? The State of the Union. Obama's next act on climate change. Wind power now cheaper than coal in some countries. Plus,
what was Germany doing correct? They've got lots of sun, right? They've got a lot more sun than we do.
Fox News surrenders to Germany in the clean energy race.
All of that and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
5 foot snowdrifts. My God. If that happens to New York, we won't find our mayor till spring.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, Winter Storm Nemo has passed. Have you survived?
Yes, somehow we managed out here in sunny California.
Oh, yeah, that's right. What do you have for us today?
Well, first, some quick headlines. Tesla Motors CEO Elon Musk says secret software installed
on... secret sauce in the Tesla?
Software.
Secret software. Oh.
Software installed on all Tesla electric cars that are lent to the media show that the New York Times ignored instructions and may have even cheated in their test drive of the range of a Tesla electric car. The New York Times, of course, denies the allegation.
Wow, did the media know that there was secret software on their cars?
No, they didn't know that. Elon Musk says they've done that ever since the British program Top Gear sort of lied about a Nissan Leaf.
Wow, busted.
Wind power is now cheaper than coal in some countries. Bloomberg New Energy Finance reports that this is already the case in Australia, partly due to a new carbon tax on that nation's biggest polluters, making non-polluting renewables more competitive, but also due to rapid improvements in turbine design and engineering. Bloomberg says globally, wind energy is now seen as a safer investment for global investors than coal over the long term. What's more, $2 trillion will flow into the global clean energy industry over the next 5 years. That's as investors focus on building clean energy power plants worldwide to meet rising demand for electricity. That's according to a new analysis of investments from the Pew Charitable Trusts. And, you know, it's weird because, you know, the climate change denial industry and the fossil fuel companies say that renewables are just a boutique industry.
Not so boutique after all?
Yeah, I don't know what the climate change denial industry knows that the clean energy investors don't.
With $2 trillion about to be invested, I think I need to open up a boutique.
The Northeast is slowly recovering from Winter Storm Nemo, record storm that dumped a record 40 inches of snow in some places, bringing the region to a standstill. Question remains if congressional Republicans will stall on disaster aid like they did after Superstorm Sandy. Climate scientists do say that global warming influenced Nemo's intensity. Unusually warm ocean temperatures boosted the intense snow dump because the air was holding 200% more moisture than is normal for that region at this time of year. Weather Underground meteorologist Christopher Burt said, quote, "It is a bit unsettling that two of the most significant storms in the past 300 years to strike the Northeast have occurred within just 4 months of each other."
Unsettling, but also somewhat helpful, frankly, that these have happened up in the Northeast, where the media and the politicos live.
Sometimes it takes a 2x4 upside the head.
Yeah.
So this happened. Pope Benedict XVI announced Monday he would be the first pope in 600 years to resign due to declining health.
And what could that possibly have to do with green news?
Oh, guess what? The 85-year-old pontiff is also notable for being the greenest pope yet. Setting aside all the other issues with the Catholic Church for a moment.
And there are plenty of them.
Oh, yes, there are. Pope Benedict was the first pope to require Vatican City to become more energy efficient and the first pope to bluntly push governments to address climate change as fundamental to social justice and responsible stewardship of creation for future generations. The Pope's surprise announcement stole some thunder from President Obama's State of the Union speech on Tuesday night. As we go to air, we're just hours away from the State of the Union speech. Environmental groups and even the Wall Street Journal have suggested Obama may introduce concrete policies to act on climate change, which he suggested he would do in his inaugural address just 3 weeks ago.
We will respond to the threat of climate change, knowing that the failure to do so would betray our children and future generations.
He will speak to it. The question is not whether he speaks to it, but whether something gets done about it.
Exactly. Finally, Fox News is surrendering to Germany, at least as far as winning the global clean energy race. On Fox and Friends, when asked why Germany's solar program was so much more successful than the United States, Fox business reporter Shivani Joshi let out this whopper.
They've got lots of sun, right? They've got a lot more sun than we do.
Right. They've got a lot more sun in Germany.
And, of course, that is crazy. Germany is so far north, it gets as much sun as Alaska. It's just that Germany has sane, deliberate energy policies that benefit ordinary ordinary Germans, so everybody wins.
For more on that story and those we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Remember, download us anytime via iTunes. Listen to us on your mobile device via Stitcher Radio or the TuneIn apps. Find us and like us on the Facebook and follow us 24/7 on the Twitters at Green News Report. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
This morning, I suddenly realized we're all in this together. I started smiling, 'cause you were smiling, and we're all in this together. I'm made of atoms, you're made of atoms, and we're all in this together. And long division doesn't matter, 'cause we're all in this together. Yeah. I saw you walking in the city. We're all in this together. The city's changing, 'cause we're changing. We're all in this together. Every 12 seconds, someone remembers that we're all in this together. In the kitchen of your rent control apartment, we're all in this together.
Something about that song that just makes me feel better. Ben Lee, a song John Fox introduced me to years and years ago, and we're all in this together. Kind of has an anthem quality to it, doesn't it? Yeah. This is The Horn. It is Tuesday night. Fat Tuesday, as Marty reminded me. We will ditch the Titanic Tuesday appellation for this evening and just honor the Fat Tuesday aspect of it. Holiday's got to be good for something, right? Somebody throw me some beads. Now, there's other stuff that I wanted to make sure that we got after this evening, though. All the Pope business is fascinating enough, I suppose. When I was listening to Brad and Desi, they were talking about how Bernard Ratzinger is the greenest Pope ever. It occurred to me that body can move along glacially. It only took him 500 years to get around to apologizing to Galileo Galilei.
And in the course of the discussion about Darwin, it should be noted that the folks over to the Vatican Observatory say that to accept the science of evolution is completely in line with so-called church teaching. So it occurred to me that the church has 99 problems, but science ain't one. That does not in any way excuse the ongoing, well, we'll save that for Wednesday. Thank you, Ed. Just got a note from Ed saying, Bob, thank you for all you do. No, no. Anything I do is only because of y'all and your determination to have independent progressive media. You know, from time to time, I have mentioned to you that you really need to be subscribed to the Your RDA of Irony blog over at FinnermanWorks.com. FinnermanWorks, FinnermanWorks.com. I have long said, and I still hold it to be true, that Eugene Finnerman is, bar none, the most brilliant satirist and tongue-in-cheek observer of history on the interweb tubes. This is a case in point. With all the Pope this and Pope that going on, and the shock that he would resign, well, Eugene, leave it to Eugene to put some perspective on it all. He writes, September 24th, 1143, Pope Innocent II dies and henceforth lives up to his name. At one time, picking a pope was simple. The congregation convened in a catacomb and elected whoever wanted his name on the top of the to-be-martyred list. In the 4th century, Constantine at least prolonged the pope's lifespan, if not his job security. Until the 8th century, the pope was a third-string bureaucrat subject to the whims of Constantinople. Some popes retired to Byzantine prisons, although they probably were more comfortable than anything still standing in Rome. But Pepin the Short, his boy Charlie, and a surprisingly efficient French army improved the status of the papacy, making the pope the biggest landholder in Rome. And with that extra incentive, every robber baron in the vicinity now wanted to be pope. A pope was chosen by the people of Rome. In other words, whoever had the toughest mob. Criminal gangs were establishing dynasties of popes. In response to the chronic scandal, German emperors would periodically march into Rome, oust the Italian scoundrel, and replace him with a, surprise, German bureaucrat who by no coincidence was the emperor's relative. Of course, when the German army left, the ousted Italian scoundrel usually returned and drove out his German replacement. This frequently left the church with two popes. In the mid-11th century, with a German army in the vicinity, the reformers in church established new rules for the election of the pope. The pontiff would no longer be the choice of the Roman gangs, but elected by a group of church prelates, established specifically for this responsibility. They would be known as cardinals. In the original rules, the cardinal's choice would require the approval of the Holy Roman Emperor. Remember that nearby German army? As soon as it left, that specific rule was forgotten. Oh yes, the pope had to be dead for 3 days before the cardinals could elect his successor. But in 1130, the papal election did not quite observe that waiting period. It had been obvious that Pope Honorius II was dying. It was also obvious that the majority of cardinals would elect the rich, charming, reputable Pier Leone, the next pope. However, his chief rival, Gregorio Paparecchi, had a very effective campaign strategy. His allies kidnapped the dying pope. Since they would be the first to know when Honorius became the late pope, the Paparecchi party would also be the first to have a papal election. They did, and guess who won?
Papa Reschi now was, however, ironically, Pope Innocent the Second. Of course, Pier Leone and his allies did not recognize Papa Reschi's usurpation. They had their own papal election, and Pier Leone became, at least to a majority of the cardinals, Pope Anacletus the Second. Pier Leone evidently did not use a focus group for that name. Rome's populace sided with Pope Anacletus, and Innocent was driven from the city. In fact, he left Italy, going first to France to plead his cause with the most powerful man in the realm. Bernard of Clairvaux would have had a deceivingly simple resume. Oh, he was just a simple monk. In fact, he was the type of person who would join a committee and within 30 minutes be running it. And Bernard liked to join lots of committees, especially royal councils and church councils. Mesmerizing and manipulating, Bernard ran France and much of the church. He definitely was the man whom Innocent had to win over. And Innocent had one very persuasive argument. Pier Leone was half-Jewish. True, the Pier Leones were only nouveau riche, but nouveau Christian. Grandpa had been the most successful usurer in Rome. Even the popes owed him. Pope Leo IX, really Bruno von... Oh, Jesus, Eugene. Really, Bruno von Eggesheim Dagsburg, cousin of Emperor Conrad II, coaxed his favorite creditor into becoming a Christian noble. Now the grandson of the usurer was claiming to be Pope. Bernard of Clairvaux wouldn't stand for that. He said, and this is a quote, "It is an injury to Christ that the offspring of a Jew should have seized for himself the throne of Saint Peter." Yeah, that accent's just terrible, isn't it? Of course, Christ was the offspring of a Jew, and so was Saint Peter. But you didn't try contradicting Bernard with logic. Pierre Abelard had and was condemned for heresy. Bernard declared his support for Pope Innocent, which then determined the decisions of French and German church councils, and their respective monarchs went along. The German emperor led an army into Italy in 1132, a now familiar itinerary, to establish Innocent in Rome. Anacletus was relegated to the quaint category of anti-pope, but he was still more popular in Rome than Innocent. The pope was only safe there in the company of a German garrison. In 1139, Innocent did become the uncontested pope by outliving Anacletus. On this day, in 1143, Innocent II died. He was never made a saint. But Bernard of Clairvaux certainly was. And, of course, it's worth remembering, unless my history is absolutely sideways, it was Bernard of Clairvaux. No, maybe it wasn't. No, it was Bernard of Clairvaux who gave the first rule of order to an organization that remains fascinating to us to this very day. We call them the Knights Templars. And from them we get silly-ass notions of things like the Illuminati. So they're... I think we've covered all the bases. Man, it's been a fun historic night. And, by the way, I'm told in the chat room by Bill of Rights Man that the State of the Union drinking words tonight are economy, jobs, and deficit. Blake and Madison noting on the other side, if you want to stay sober, however, for the State of the Union address, the words to listen to for our Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, and Eighth Amendment, because they will not be mentioned, and you will therefore not have to drink. Oh, wow. Sparky, one of our chat room moderators, reporting that the cabin where Chris Dorner is, the man being hunted in California, is on fire. Sparky says they're roasting him. Wow. So now at about 10 minutes before the hour, I have a piece of serious business to go through with you. You know, from time to time that I get objections about the way we address, and it's not Wednesday, but we'll just take care of this business right now. From time to time, I get objections, usually from one source. About how we handle religion on this program. And how we handle stories of the almost entirely corrupt clerical system, whether it be Roman Catholic or Southern Baptist or any variation between. So a little bit ago, I received a note. And it said, "For God's sake, please stop your remarks about Christ and leave out anti-clerical remarks. I and other listeners," God knows whom they would be, "have found these rants offensive and have made my blood run cold. Get over being a recovering whatever and stop reopening that wound." There's no small amount of irony in being told to get over recovering from something. Note to the women folk out there who have been subjected to rape, get over recovering from your rape and stop reopening that wound. Okay? Because, you see, that's what religion is like, at least. There is nothing that can ever compare to the horrors of actual rape. I even get a little queasy when I describe things that the corporations want to do to the places where real human beings live as environmental rape. I kind of think rape deserves to live in a category of agony and pain all by itself. Sort of the way we try to let the Holocaust live in its private category of anguish. All you Holocaust survivors, get over being a recovering Holocaust survivor and stop reopening that wound. But regardless, what I said in response to that statement was that we will do some real democracy. We gotta live that, right? Remember that here in America, here in the United States, we're all that's America. Mexico, the global South, that's them. We're America. Here in the United States, democracy is at best an aspirational goal. It is certainly not a reality. So why don't we do some? Let's take a vote. And we will keep the polling open until, showtime tomorrow night. Because by then, everybody should have either have had a chance to listen live or to listen to the podcast. So we will have a 24-hour voting period, simple majority, And if you are of the impression that we should censor this program and not talk about the realities of religion, and not talk about the priests who, in their God knows thousands, do what they do, and the preachers and the pastors. If we should leave rank superstition and adherence to imaginary beings alone, say so. Say so. Vote. Send me an email. If you want to respond by phone, lines are open right now, and we'll record your vote that way. 304-658-3333. Yeah, that's definitely a dial tone. Or chime in on Skype. Bob Kincaid Horn. BobKincaidHorn. Well, the voting's already started in the chat room. Our chat room moderator, Lottie, noting, in my opinion, Bob doesn't desecrate Christ at all. In fact, he's defending him. The Christians do a good enough job themselves at desecrating him. So, there's... we don't often do poll questions on this program, but there's one. Do we need to lay off the religion industry? Does your blood also run cold? And I'm trying to think back to what must have engendered this latest complaint. And the one that I remember most vividly is the story we had, you know, and I didn't make it up. But the story we had recently of the man of God in South America who had convinced his parishioners that they had to take communion from the end of his penis, telling them that the sacred, blessed milk of Jesus Christ was what happened when he orgasmed into their mouths. It is what it is. It's fact-based. Here's Marty's vote. My vote. Keep bringing it, Bob. I might not always agree, but I definitely want to hear it. Yeah, Marty continuing. He says, stop railing about the religious-industrial congressional complex. Hell no. Bring it on. So let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the conversation.
Hey, good afternoon, Bob.
Hey, Kevin, what's happening?
Well, I had to respond to this because I have kind of a unique perspective of having been on both sides of this issue at one time or the other. And the thing that comes to me, firstly, is that we have a little thing here in the United States called freedom of speech, which...
Well, but by the same token, Kevin, let's stop right there real quick.
Sure.
That only applies to governmental attempts to suppress speech. So this is just the only reason I bring it up is every time somebody, for instance, well, when people went after Rush Limbaugh for his vile attacks on a real, tangible, visible person named Sandra Fluck,
right,
he complained that they were trying to cheat him of his freedom of speech by telling his advertisers not to advertise on his program anymore. Okay? Well, of course, that was not true.
No.
The government had not in any wise intruded upon his right to express himself. But the First Amendment, and by its operation through the 14th Amendment, does not operate conversely to create a duty upon the government or upon the business community, or upon the people at large, to subsidize an individual.
Right.
Luckily, we have no advertisers.
Well.
So that does create freedom here.
Yeah.
We have the freedom of non-support.
And by the same thing, if I was responding to Limbaugh saying that, I would say, no, that's the blessed marketplace that you talk about taking hold, because people are asking advertisers to bill on you because of your outrageous speech. The advertisers don't have to sponsor you. They have a choice. So, but anyway, getting back to what I'm saying, I kind of agree with what Lottie said, because I would much rather, I don't want to say hear about the bad stuff, but on the same token, it needs to be heard. And earlier today, I answered a survey asking me what religion I was, and I said, a supposed Christian who is fed up with the religious industry in general, and with the Christian fundamentalist in particular, you know. And but on the other hand, I still have this spiritualism inside me that's not going to come
and away. And that is not something that I am ever going to criticize.
No.
I simply prefer that, because first, okay, can we have a little digression into the nature of religion?
Sure.
The whole problem with, you know, all religions begin, and I'm using the term in its anthropological sense and not with all the pejoratives that are attached to it. All religions begin as cults. Okay? That's the word we use to describe little proto-religions. And they rise from personal cult all the way up to ecclesiastical cults. And for instance, the Roman Catholic Church is an ecclesiastical cult. That's the term, the scientific term you use if you want to discuss these institutions.
Right.
At least the way I was taught. By some pretty darn fine religion and anthropology professors. But all religions begin as personal cults. Either the shaman has a dream and reports it to the members of the tribal group, and it has relevance for them and provides sort of go-forward meaning, or responds to other, some sort of need, or in many instances, the shaman is trying to exercise his will upon the people, whether it is for his own advancement or because of his personal, or her, remember, most early cults were probably matriarchal ones. That's why they tend to be a little bit less awful, because they were related to fertility and birth and death and natural processes, earth mother, sky god, that kind of thing.
Right.
But they begin as personal cults. When somebody has a message and other people start saying, we need to listen to her or him. And that's the story of Christianity. There is no word, the word Christian doesn't exist in the Gospels.
Nope. Not once. Other than where it was added.
You know, it gets invented by St. Paul.
Right.
And when a cult arises, it often splinters, as happened with the early church. But at no point in time, until and unless it has the force of government behind it, does it have the power to say, you may say this about our cult, but not that. That's what happens in the 4th century of the Common Era when Constantine takes Christianity under its wing. And even then, the schisms were happening left and right, or schisms, I'm not sure which. The Arian heresy dogged the reign of Constantine, and the followers of Christ were constantly at each other's throats. Constantine tried to suppress the Arian heresy, and that's not, this is not Arian as in, you know, the Arian people, Hitler, all that stuff. This is a bishop named Arian who had different thoughts about how the magic worked. And they tried to suppress it, but lo and behold, Constantine wound up only being baptized right before death, and lo and behold, he was baptized by an Arian bishop. So, you know, this the purpose of this little digression into the origins of religion is by way of saying that whatever people wish to believe is fine,
yep.
But one's belief does not confer special status not to have it criticized, mocked, poked fun at, analyzed, any of that. Makes sense?
Makes perfect sense to me. I think back to the way you're saying that, and you think back to the reign of Bush the Dim, and where you couldn't criticize anything he was doing because you were unpatriotic. And granted, that wasn't a religion per se, but it had those kind of scary overtones for me.
Right, well, and it does. It's not just overtones. It takes on qualities of a cult.
What?
When you may not criticize the cult, and someone is able to be an enforcer of it,
yep.
There you go.
So, anyway, I occasionally and very occasionally might get insulted by something you say or do, but really, in the long run, I look at the church and say, if you're insulted by it, then clean it up.
Right. And just going back to that digression for 1 minute, the one point I wanted to draw out of it is that when what we understand as Christianity was merely a personal cult, the personal cult of the Rabbi Yeshua, the Palestinian day laborer,
yep.
Many people were put off by it. But a core group of people were touched by it. But you can make the argument that they weren't even sure why they were touched. Okay? That's why, despite the fact that just about everything that Yeshua talks about is about how one lives one's daily life, it got institutionalized into how to run the world.
Right.
So that you wind up, for instance, with a dead sniper in Texas, a murdered sniper in Texas, who wrote his own autobiography, and the murdered sniper in Texas took credit for in excess of 200 deliberate killings, and describes himself as a follower of a man who said, "Put thy sword in his place. He who lives by the sword shall die by the sword." And then when crazy old cranky old Ron Paul said that very thing, the right wing erupted into paroxysms of fury. How dare he say such a thing about a patriot, which is exactly what you just mentioned. And so what the totality of this says to me, Kevin, and why I say I will never criticize anyone's personal spirituality as long as they keep it to themselves inside their spirit.
Exactly. Yep.
Is because that's genuine, regardless of what it's based on.
Yep.
Whether it's based on something Yeshua said, or something Mithras said, or something Muhammad said, or something the Flying Spaghetti Monster said.
Yep.
As long as it's personal, it's fine. It is when it gets out. It's when Pandora's religious box gets flung open and the bats begin flying around, that we begin to have problems.
Yeah. And
so, you know, I've maybe gotten near it, danced around it a little bit from time to time. But I've never talked about what my spirituality is, what I think or don't think. I can tell you what I reject. I obviously reject the notion of some bearded juvenile delinquent in the sky running around smiting people. I reject that.
Yep.
There's a whole host of other things I reject. I reject any organized institutional faith that says women are dirty, like the Roman Catholic Church and most of Protestantism does at its very root. I reject that. I reject any faith system that says some people are better than others. For any one of a variety of reasons, whether it be being a membership in the cult and adhering to the dogma, or because of color of skin. Lots of Christianity, as Dr. John's note mentioned earlier, did that. Remember polygenesis.
Yep.
So, you know, that's where, you know, that's where I stand. And the thing is, a spirituality that is internal can be a spirituality that works for good.
Yep.
Spirituality externalized and institutionalized, however, more often than not, winds up working more harm than good. Witness the Roman Catholic Church's ongoing inability to even cope, let alone deal, with its nasty little rape problem.
Yep.
So, you know, that's where, you know, that's where I stand.
Yeah.
I hope that makes some sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I had to respond because having grew up in the church, you know, it's something that I have a part of me in me, but I've seen so much bad that I can't be a part of that institution as it currently is, because I've told you on the program before, I was once told, you know, how can you be a Christian and be a Democrat? Okay, well, if you don't know the answer to that, I'm not going to bother to explain it to you. Go ahead and go off on your own thinking.
Well, it's kind of like that Darwin inquiry I mentioned earlier, isn't it? It's kind of an IQ test.
Yeah, and that's a very good IQ test, because even in my younger days of Christianity, I never can remember rejecting Darwin and his theories. It always seemed to me to work hand in hand as totally opposed to. I had no problem with not believing that the world was created in 7 24-hour days as we know them, kind of thing. You know, I mean, you look at rocks, there's just so much evidence for what Darwin talked about, you know, that you can't deny it. You can question how it happened, but you can't deny what Darwin saw. And in the same way, I guess what really, you know, I guess what I'm really trying to...
It's kind of difficult, doesn't it?
Yeah, because what I'm trying to say and put into words is that I don't have the, and this may be not the right thing to say, but I don't have the right to tell you what to believe. You don't have the right to tell me what to believe. As listeners of a show, as a listener of your show, I may write you and tell you I have a problem with something, and you may, as you have, offer to make it a democratic process, but in reality, it's your talk show, you know? And if I don't like it, I know where the knob is. No, I'm not suggesting that listeners should leave your show, but, you know, you know, I just am tired of people telling me, that's really the essence of it right there. I'm tired of people telling me what I have to believe, what I have to think, and what I have to say. And so, yeah, you would definitely find me in the column of continue doing as you're doing. I have no problem with it. So I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to be mean to the person that said that, because I empathize with them to an extent, but I just don't feel I have the right to tell you what to do with your show And granted, you've opened it up as a democratic process, but I'm perfectly happy with what you're doing.
Well, thank you, Kevin. You'll get a kick out of this. Irish Dave pointing out in a note that was titled A Blast from the Past, the showing of Oh God was protested by Mormons in Boise, Idaho, because God was portrayed in that movie by a Jew, George Burns.
Oh, my God. See why I wandered out of the church, and that's kind of.
Well, I'm getting hand cramps just tallying up the votes here.
Yeah, it's something I.
So far, we've moved into the realm of dozens to one.
Yeah, and I suspected that to some extent, but just on the whole of should we do a church night, just on that question alone, I think everybody enjoys it.
Yeah, and I give that creepy old dude a rest every now and then.
Sure.
Just because, but the thing is, the religion industry won't give us a rest.
Right.
Because last week it was the story of the preacher with the magic Jesus spooge. And this week, what'll it be? Pick an abuse.
There's so innumerable.
It's not limited to Christianity.
No. But they go. There's a lot that go hand in hand with Christianity and the extreme right wing morons that we run into on a day to day basis. Because it's all predicated on that you have to believe as I believe and do as I do. Well, not even do as I do as I say to do.
And then leave me the hell alone to do as I wish.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And you see that in the Christian circles. I mean, like you said, it's not even a matter of one week it's this, one week it's that. It's almost more like one day it's this and one day it's that as far as stories coming out. And I wish it weren't so. I know there's some good, very good people out there in the church, but those are in the local.
Yeah, and the thing is, they would be good because, this is... Let us also understand that this is not a one. Long before I ever took to the microphone, the religion in, well, Jesus, I mean, we're talking about, in Christianity's case, 2,000 years, they've been screaming that they've got the answers and we're nasty. One of the chief talking points, for instance, of the religion industry these days is that you can't have no morals without you being Christian.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Well, you mentioned, good people in churches. That's the thing. They're good people. They would be good people. They would be good Muslims. They would be good Hindus. They would be good Jains. They would be good Jews. They are good Christians of their understanding. They would be good animists. They would be good Shinto. They would be good Buddhists. They would be good Confucians because they're good people.
Right.
Religion doesn't make people good. People put a good face on religion.
Yeah.
Because they hope to get pie in the sky when they die. Or in the case, perhaps, of Buddhism, no pie, no sky, and snuffed out.
Either way, I do think there's good people out there that aren't looking for that pie in the sky. They're just good people, like you say. But more importantly, they're not looking for anything out of religion. At least some of the people I'm thinking about, they genuinely want to help others and do what good they can in this world, in this lifetime, regardless. But...
Well, consider what Lottie just posted in the chat room, Kevin. This from someone named Steven Weinberg. With or without religion, you would have good people doing good things and evil people doing evil things. But for good people to do evil things, That takes religion.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what... Do you remember the story this week sometime? Someone was talking about how the aborted babies might go to hell.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was an Alabama legislator named... Oh, Shadrach Needle Dick or something. His first name really is Shadrach.
Yeah.
We have to stop abortion because them aborted babies might be going to hell.
And see, that's where it makes your point exactly, because how in God's name could you think your God or my God or could send a baby that hasn't even been born yet to hell? You know, I mean, it just drives me. And that's why I don't go to church, is simply that right there, because of stupidity mounted upon stupidity. And I can't take it. I've got too much of a mind to me, I guess, that I never did consider that this way was the right way. In addition to that, I've always considered things outside the box. Don't know that I believe them, but I've considered them, things such as reincarnation, things like that. You know, I don't want to be boxed in. And that's what I see religion doing, and it's been going on. The church history, you mentioned Constantine. He was one of the worst. Jew and Arab alike were put to death because they would not become a Christian. And if I were a Jew or Arab back in that time, I would look at that faith and say, what kind of a faith is that I have to believe at the point of a sword? Kill me. You know, I just can't understand. And the church today, and this is the common church people I'm talking about at this point, they don't know their own history. And I venture to say that that's probably true of the three major religions, Christian, Jew, and Muslim. All three of them don't know their own history. I think the Jews, because of the way they documented lineage and that, might have a better understanding of it, but I know Christianity because I've lived it. I've had people tell me that I'm lying about Constantine. You know, this is documented history. And so, you know, I didn't mean to stay on this long. It just, you've opened up a wound in me, and it needs to be open, because you never look at a recovering alcoholic and say you're not an alcoholic. You don't give a recovering alcoholic a drink. And in the same way, just as I'm a recovering Christian, so to speak, I've got to get some of this out. And by you telling me I can't say this or do that, and I'm not talking about the person that wrote you the letter, I'm thinking more of people I run into here in a fundamentalist city that want me to believe a certain way and, you know, just won't do it.
It's not like there's not some history to this. There's a saying out there that is paraphrased, Kevin, and is said to have come from Denis Diderot, may have actually come from Jean Maybier, about and his hands would plait the priest's entrails for want of a rope to strangle kings. And it's attributed to Jean Maillier. I would like, and this would be the last and most ardent of my wishes, I would like the last of the kings to be strangled by the guts of the last priest.
Yep.
You know, that's something that was being said back when they actually burned people to death for saying it.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Oh, by the way, yeah, our boy's name is Shadrach McGill, not Shadrach Needledick. That was... but the latter probably also applies. Kevin, I appreciate your thoughts. I genuinely do, and you have a wonderful evening.
Well, thank you for letting me get some of this out, because it does, it is a wound that I want to be there, because I want it to cause me to think and to cause me to remember at the same time.
Indeed. Thank you, Kevin. Have a good evening.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Calling from Colorado Springs, that's our buddy Kevin. Just a smattering of some of the responses that have come in. Dan says, you can roast all religions as you need to, because they're as politically and political and corrupt as any entities in human history. Do not, and this is in all caps, do not lay off the religion industry. Would Bill Hicks, peace be upon him, want this? No, he would not. Then there's Barry. No censoring. Bring it on. I'll take my crazy straight. No chaser. Let's see. Randy. There is certainly enough media to express pro-belief content, and I appreciate a pro-atheist, agnostic, or otherwise mystical, analytical point of view. He offers this, but it doesn't sound like... However, I don't know if constant religion industry bashing makes good radio, just like Mike Malloy can go overboard on the right-wing bashing, which might not make good radio. So we'll take that as a half yes, half no. Talking Snake writes in, no, don't give religion a pass. I don't think anyone has a right not to be offended. And that's at the essence of this. Religions, because they've had the power in the past to kill people for disagreeing with them and have done so with ruthless efficiency, would like to continue to suppress criticism. Let's see. Let me see if I can find another one here. Oh, Jack in Shreveport. Bob, a thought crossed my mind in that I don't agree with single-issue voting, so I guess I would hope that people wouldn't have a single issue turning off the radio attitude. Or the horn. And there are a lot of these. Let's continue. Hey, welcome to the program.
This is Edward.
Well, hey, Edward, how are you?
I'm fine. I've enjoyed the program. I agree with you completely. And I would like to say I believe in life before death.
Amen. Or as the deep-voiced fellow at the front row of the Baptist church, and all God's children said, amen.
Amen. Amen and amen. Well, I appreciate people's beliefs and that sort of thing, but they can believe whatever they want to. Just don't tell me I have to believe the same way they do.
Exactly. It's that old Jefferson Starship song, isn't it?
Yeah.
What's the name of this? Miracles. Miracles. If only you'd believe the way I do, we'd get by.
Well.
But I can't, Edward, I can't subsume my brains, and I'm not offering them up as any particularly excellent brains, but I know that the sun does not stand still in the sky.
Me too.
I know that even though we say the sun rises in the east, that the sun isn't rising. I know that the earth is turning.
Yeah.
It's what Dr. John was saying at the beginning of the program about insisting that we do our learning by observable, testable science.
Yeah, when I was just a child, I used to catch tadpoles and watch them turn into frogs. Little things like that.
Yeah.
So, what a changeable world we live in, and I appreciate people who are religious, but I'm sorry for them, in a way.
Yeah.
So...
They will never know how really good they are, because they think that some institution is making them good,
or making them bad. That's the worst.
Yeah, well, sure. You remember Flip Wilson? You remember Geraldine, right?
Oh, my name is Geraldine.
The devil made me do it.
Oh, we love that. I used to watch that with this cousin of mine, Miss Edna. She was born in 1885, and she just loved Geraldine. But she was a rather unusual lady. She was a Southern lady.
Well, not that I'm being accusatory, but that may those two may be a little bit redundant, Edward. She was an unusual lady. She was a Southern lady. I think you can say either one, and the one implies the other.
Yes, the old time. You'd never know it until you get to know her. But she told me my first dirty joke. It was a Victorian dirty joke, which I can't tell you.
Well, darn. I don't know that I've ever heard a Victorian dirty joke. Now you've piqued my curiosity. Will you at least email it to me?
Yes. I'll email it to you.
Okay.
It's not. It only has one four-letter word in it.
But it works. It works to devastating effect, I'll warrant.
Yes. And, of course, she was one of my delights growing up these years. I think she had a lot of influence on me. She was a Primitive Baptist. The Primitive Baptist Church there in my hometown has a historical marker on it. It's so old. But those Primitive Baptists didn't think drinking or dancing was a sin.
Didn't.
No, in fact.
Well, no. For instance, I was reading. You know, I wandered off down the historical rabbit hole the other day. Do you know? I'm sure. Well, I'm not going to make any assumptions or speculations or anything. But you're probably familiar with Kentucky bourbon whiskey.
Oh yes.
Well,
Jack Daniel's. Yes.
Well, that's Tennessee now, Edward. I mean,
Tennessee.
There are people who will take sore umbrage at that. On both sides of the state line, I'll add. It turns out that a whole bunch of the earliest distillers, because at the time that people were immigrating into what would become Kentucky, they were largely coming from, mostly coming from Virginia, because the territory that was Virginia was actually part of, that was Kentucky, was part of Virginia.
Yeah.
As was West Virginia. Big. I mean, it was presumed to go all the way to the Pacific Ocean. Virginians are like that. At the time that the immigration into Kentucky was taking place, the dominant spirit in this country was one of two things. It was either rum or rye whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when white folks and their enslaved peoples began moving into Kentucky, they began growing corn, and they began making corn liquor.
Yep.
And because of the fascination that Southerners tend to have for royalty, they named their whiskey after the Royal House of France. Bourbon.
Well.
And so, I guess it's kind of that they all turn into shaggy dog tails when I start telling them, Edward. I'm sorry. A number of the people who first successfully began making and selling corn liquor in what would become Kentucky were Baptist ministers.
Well, see, there's my cousin Edna. And every night, when she went to bed, she had to have her toddy. Because sometimes I would go stay with her when the family was all away, and she was there by herself, so I would go stay with her. The back part of the house was very old. It had a working fireplace in it that with spits and hooks and all this sort of stuff. And sometimes, just for fun, we'd cook in the fireplace, and she'd bake cornbread in a spider. You know what that is?
No.
It's like an iron frying pan sitting up on three legs, and it has a great long handle.
Okay, yeah, I didn't know that was the word for it.
It's a spider, yeah. That's called a spider. And do that, and we'd have beans out of the pot, and we just had a good time together.
You ever had a cobbler baked in a fire in a Dutch oven?
I've had it in hers. In the
mercy sakes.
Thing.
Oh, my goodness. Nothing like it. Absolutely nothing like it.
Well, I'll tell you. Oh, I was going to tell you something else, but I know what. Talking about liquor, my granddaddy was born in 1864, and he made this concoction in a crock, and it had a lid on it and a little spigot down at the bottom, and he called it Cherry Bounce. You mashed up the cherries and the pits, put them in, some sugar, another layer all the way to the top, and then you filled it up with homemade liquor.
And oh.
For about 2 or 3 months. And then it was only for medicinal purposes, but it seemed like my granddaddy sort of got sick every afternoon about 4 o'clock. And it was in the pantry off the kitchen. And I'd go in with him, and he'd say, "Now, son, I'll give you a taste of this if you don't tell your grandmother." I said, "I won't tell." And he'd say, "You're going to have to dance hoppy kicky with me." I said, "What?" He said, "Here, take a sip of this." I'd take a sip of the Cherry Bounce, and then I'd hold his hands, and we'd dance around in the pantry. That is the most absolutely unusual scene. This old man and this donkey get drunk in the pantry taking Cherry Bounce. And lo and behold, I was looking through a book of early American drinks, and there it was. Cherry Bounce.
I'll be darned. Well, yep. So what you poured on, was it a clear corn liquor or a?
Yeah, it was clear.
Okay, so
the kind that would kill you.
Yeah, kindly raw, shall we say?
Mm-hmm. But after it soaked in those cherries and sugar for a while, it was some kind of good.
But it was ground up pits included.
You smash the pits too to get the flavor from them.
Oh dear, I have a project. All right, Edward, I got to tell you this. We're having an there's an uprising going on in the chat room and in the email box.
What?
I saw this here just a minute ago. Come on, Bob. This is what we pay for internet for. And then Sergi said, "Oh, come on. This isn't terrestrial radio. Let's hear that joke." So unless it's going to make you just turn purple or something.
Okay, I'll tell you.
All right.
Told to me by my cousin Edna. There was this schoolhouse back in the late 1800s, and it was a two-room, and they had a pot-bellied stove in the classrooms, but the hall was cold. And this young man acted up, so the teacher took him out to the hallway and said, "Now you are going to stand out in this hallway until you can make a joke. I'm sorry, make a poem to recite to the class." So she goes back into the classroom. About 5 minutes, she comes back out, and he's freezing to death. She says, "Do you have the poem?" He says, "No." She goes back. This happens several times. Finally, she goes out. Do you have the poem yet? No. Then he sees this cockroach climbing up the wall, and he says, "Here I stand in the cold, cold hall, watching a cockroach climb the wall." The teacher comes out and says, "Do you have the poem?" And he says, "Yes." And she says, "Let's hear it." So he says, "Here I stand in the cold, cold hall, watching a cockroach climb the wall." And he says, the teacher says, "That's fine. Come back in and recite it to the class. Just say roach." So back they go. And he stands up in front of the class, and he says, "Here I stand in the cold, cold hall, watching a roach climb the wall with his cock out." That was told me by a lady born in 1885.
I'll be all right in a minute.
Sorry, I didn't mean to get you all upset.
Oh, I'm not upset. Oh, God. Oh, my God. All right, all right. You've made the chat room happy.
Well, good. That's
made my night.
That's a real Victorian joke.
Oh, this is one of those moments I miss my dad. I'd get off the air, Edward, and I'd run into the living room and tell, okay, one good one deserves another one.
Yeah.
And this one's a little bit more coarse, but one day I told my, you know, little Johnny jokes are a dime a dozen, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a visual to it, but it's not that important. But little Johnny jokes have a way of being kind of off color. But little Johnny was in class one day, and the teacher knew his proclivities and his tendency toward vulgarity. But, you know, she had a job to do. And so that day they were working with the alphabet. You know, it's first grade. And she says, all right, class, we're going to go through all the letters of the alphabet, and everybody has to come up with a word. I'm going to give the letter, and you have to come up with a word and spell it. And she says, all right, A. Lo and behold, there's little Johnny, first one with his hand up. And the teacher thinks, oh, my word, I can't let him do A. And so little Susie, A. Little Susie says, apple. A-P-P-L-E. That's very good, little Susie. B. Bang. Little Johnny's arm goes up again. And she's thinking, oh, what's it? Oh, no, that's too easy. Timmy. And he says, B. Bat. B-A-T. Okay, let's do the letter C. And again, little Johnny. And the teacher begins thinking of what he can do with C. And no. And so she says, all right, Timmy. And he says, C, cat, C-A-T. And so she goes all the way down through the alphabet. Every time she mentions a letter, little Johnny's there with his hand up.
Mm-hmm.
And she knows he's up to something. Until she gets to R. And there's little Johnny again. And she thinks to herself, my word, what harm can he possibly do with R? And she says, all right, little Johnny, R. Little Johnny stands up solemnly, folds his hands across his tummy, and says, R, rat, R-A-T, rat. Great big goddamn rat with a dick this big. I told that to my father, and he came apart.
Oh, Moisey.
So you're a bad boy.
Yes, you are, Bob Kincaid. You're a bad boy.
Oh, and he told me the same thing as the tears were streaming down his face and he was gasping for breath trying to.
Well, what do you think I did was when my cousin Edna told me about that?
I'm in all pieces. I'm so hanging on to that one, Edward.
Oh well, good. I hope so. And think of Miss Edna when you think of it. She was born in 1885.
I will indeed.
My very dear cousin.
I will try to make sure that she is appropriately credited the next time I tell it, which will be as soon as the show's over and I go and tell it to Agnes.
Well, take care, y'all, and keep talking about religion. I think we need to talk about it.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very kindly, Edward.
Yeah. We need to talk about it and think about it.
All right. Thanks so much. You have a good night.
Thank you.
Bye now. That is our dear, dear buddy Edward calling from Dallas. This coming in from Darlene on the issue, the poll question of the evening. Remember, voting is open until the beginning of showtime tomorrow night. She says, I think it's the entrails of the last priest with regard to the Diderot comment. And I think that's the way it is sometimes translated, entrails, guts. She says, are you sure the one complainer isn't a conservative plant or something? Keep it coming, Bob. No censoring. No, I'm pretty sure that's not a right-wing plant. And Jack in Shreveport, subject line, Edward's killing me. Jack says, there have been a few things that cracked me up since Edward called. but I stepped on a cockroach barefoot last night. I was reminded of it by Edward's joke. It's a Southern thing, you know, the stepping on part. Well, yeah, and the barefoot part, too, Jack. I mean, come on. Randy, with regard to the cherry bounce, he says, you got to watch those cherry pits. Some contain cyanide compounds, giving them their almond flavor. I thought that was peach pits or apricot pits. Maybe it is cherries. Maybe it's that whole stone fruit family. One never. Thank you. Thank you, Randy. It is about 14 minutes before the hour. Let's see if we can get another call in. Hey, welcome to the conversation.
You got him. How you doing?
What's happening, Jim?
You.
Trying.
First, I'm the one who objected to what you do on Wednesday nights, okay? And I'll let everybody know it, and I'm not ashamed of it, okay?
Okay, you've just been wildly outvoted, that's all.
Well, that's okay. Wouldn't be the first time in my life.
Yeah, we did live through the Bush administration, didn't we?
Won't be the second time either.
No, there were two Bush elections.
And, you know, I'm sure you know from our past conversations over the years that I am no prude.
No.
And I am no right-wing religious fundamentalist.
No.
It's just that that's not the type of faith that I was brought up in, okay?
That's fine.
And I don't appreciate what you said about Christ and the personal things and stuff like that, and I'll let it be known. Just as I will, you know, share all types of things with you by email.
Right, but Jim.
Don't overtalk me, please.
Jim, there is a difference between making your voice heard or voicing your objection and telling me how to program this show and what to talk about and not to talk about. Okay?
I didn't tell you anything. I just made a suggestion. You're the one who made it public. Not me.
When people email this program, it's for public purposes,
well,
unless they say otherwise.
Okay, did you mention anything about that's the DeMaurier novel that I suggested that your wife might like to read?
No. Yeah, I told her about them.
Oh, good. I'm glad you did.
You directed that toward her.
And you as well, because it's good prose.
Yeah. I don't doubt
that.
And
I'm ashamed to say what I feel.
Well, I don't, and I don't think you should be. But the line is between, and yes, you did. You specifically said, lay off it.
I wish you would, because there are other people who don't like it either.
Well, I don't know who they are, and frankly, they haven't written to me.
Well, maybe they don't have the courage to, or they don't want to be subject to ridicule.
Or, well, you haven't been subjected to ridicule in this conversation.
Well,
I didn't even put your name in it, Jim.
I know, and that's the reason I called you.
And I was doing that to prevent that happening, because I knew the response would be what it is.
Well, that's great. And if that's what you knew, that's what you want, that's fine.
Well, I knew that, Jim, because we've been down this road before, and you've tried to say that more people object to it, and so, no, they don't. They don't.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't know. You're the one keeping the tallies, not me. But do you want to hear a real dirty Victorian joke?
You can outdo Edward?
Maybe.
Okay.
There were two couples in evening dress, circa 1890, seated at a round table. And as I saw it, one man was rising, shaking his fist at another. And he said, "Damn it, man, you just farted in front of my wife." And the other gentleman said, not rising from his chair, "Pardon me, I didn't realize it was her turn."
Oh, see, I love that stuff, Jim. I do. It's like from earlier this evening, and I don't think you tuned in yet when we were going over the little. Did you hear the press release from the right wingers about? You know, will Obama mention abortion in his speech?
I don't listen to those people, Bob.
Well, no. I mean, I read it. I didn't read it to get their message out. I read it because it was one of those moments when I got just a delightful laugh out of the absolute, I don't know what you'd call it. You would say innocent in other terms, but these people are not innocent.
Hardly.
But the, it's down. Just Yeah, no, that wasn't it. Oh, here it is. Here it is. When will President Obama address the unborn? And this is just one of those language moments. Tonight, we would like, and just, you know, there's nothing untoward in this. It's just a delightful ignorance of language. Tonight, we would like President Obama to name just one protection of the child in the womb he favors.
Bob, you know, I don't understand that. Do you really understand that comment?
Well, I understand what it means in the plain English that I just read.
Well, you know, I've always heard, and I believe you me, I've talked with enough right-wing fundamentalists who say that all these unborn babies and all the ones that are aborted go immediately back to the well of souls in heaven. And whether it's Shadrach, Meshach, or Abednego, or wherever the fuck the guy's name was who made that stupid
thing. Shadrach McGill, yes.
Well, I mean, you know, he's full of shit.
Like a Christmas goose.
So, you know, I won't...
But the point of that, though, is language. One protection of the child in the womb he favors.
And the,
could we fairly assume from that language that they're talking about Michelle Obama? And is this one of those Freudian moments for the anti-abortion industry, in which they sort of by being a bubble off plum indicate that they view women as wombs and not as complete functioning full on human beings?
I don't know. I've never thought of women like that, so I can't even compute with that. Really, I can't.
No, that was that little piece of language was a surefire moment with Dr. Freud.
I mean, to me, the First Lady is Michelle Obama, and I have a great deal of respect for her, as well as do her husband. I don't agree with what he says sometimes and the way he does it. And I hope he's going to be able to correct some mistakes, God willing.
That's why I don't have that much interest in what's going to be said tonight. Not because I think he's not going to be truthful, or not because I think he's a bad person or a good person, but because he is laying out an agenda with a Congress that is the political equivalent of chimps flinging poo.
Well, I mean, you heard what the Speaker of the House said about him today.
No, what?
And how he was full of shit, basically.
What? No, back up.
That's basically what he said. He was just full of shit, and that he would oppose him in every way he could.
Boehner said that?
Yeah, it was a very nasty comment. I can't remember because I've been following this thing in California, as well as some other things. I have a sick cat.
You've got a sick cat?
Yeah, but nonetheless, I mean, he said some things that if I were the president, I would reel right around and knock him right out of his fucking chair.
And then they could talk about what an angry black man he is.
Well, I would have the greatest respect in the world, the way I do for many angry black men, like the Reverend Al Sharpton and so many others that have come to the fore.
Oh, speaking of the Reverend Al, let me, you know that the greatest amount of hay has been made, Jim, out of the presence of the man they refer to as the Nuge, being at the State of the Union tonight, right?
Oh, Ted Nugent?
Yeah.
Oh, what the fuck is he doing there?
Oh, he's been invited there by Representative Steve Stockton.
I know. And, you know, the guy has been investigated by the Secret Service for making all kinds of comments. As far as I'm concerned, I'd be more than happy to see either of his two wishes come true.
Well, check this out. He recently said, and this is a quote, he recently said that Jesse Jackson and Al Not-So-Sharpton would be lisping their Ebonic mumbo-jumbo that the policy and the president are racist and bigoted if a Republican president had the same drone policy as the Obama administration's.
Now, who said this? Excuse me. You lost me there for a second.
Ted Nugent.
Well, I mean, isn't he...
Referred to Jesse Jackson and Al Not-So-Sharpton, har-har.
Well, isn't he one to reflect on drone policy?
Yeah, be, I mean, that they would be lisping their Ebonic mumbo-jumbo. You know, why, at that, by the time you've gone that far down the road, you may as well just use the N-word.
Well, let's face it. Ted dropped too many tabs of that bad acid back in the 70s when he was with the Amboy Dukes. And he's just absolutely nuts. And if I had my way, his ass would be in jail.
They're in a home.
No, he was.
I mean, if he's nuts, we don't want to put the mentally ill in jail. That's what the right wing wants to do.
No, no, he'd be in jail as far as I'm concerned.
He's criminally insane.
Exactly, and that's where these people need to be. But I wanted to come to this program to admit I'm the one, the dissenter, and if I'm a minority of one, that's fine. It's happened before, and it's happened before lots of times on this program. I mean, how many people have told you about ganging up a bong that was powered by an aquarium pump?
That's one for the ages, Jim.
And how many of you have come up with a lot of stories I've told on this program, too?
No. You're absolutely a delight in the community.
But I do have a belief, and I do have a belief in the Lord.
Well, that's fine.
And that's all I wanted to say, Bob.
That's fine.
I didn't want to make any big, moratorium on it or whatever. I didn't want to do that. But I just wanted to, I thought, you know, I was trying to be helpful.
I appreciate that, Jim.
Not hurtful.
I do.
Helpful.
I do. But, you did put it in terms of, stop doing that.
I wish you would, because, I mean, you know...
But I can't, Jim. I can't.
Well, there are many ways to do it. There are many ways...
I mean, I don't know of a nice way to tell a story about a preacher using religion to force his flock to fellate him.
Well, that's just absolutely sick.
Yes, it is.
And as far as fellatio is concerned, well, that's a term I'm certainly not unfamiliar with, but I certainly didn't use that type of inducement. So this man's just crazy. He's just as mad as a hatter.
And the question is, what is the role that religion plays in that?
It plays no role whatsoever. Because, I mean, Alpha, have you seen...
Had he not, but Jim, and we're running out of time, but had he not had access to that flock, he would not have had 30 people on their knees in front of him.
Well, you know, there's a recent special on TV about how Catholic priests had done that, same type of thing, and have...
Right, and that's why I want nothing whatsoever to do with any organized religion at all.
Well,
because as the scripture says, Jim, all have sinned and come so short of the glory of God. And I don't believe that nearly as much about human beings as I do about the alleged God's alleged church.
Well, that's fine. That's your belief. But, you know, I can filter out a lot of things that are bad and say there are a lot of things that are good, too. And so that's my point on coming on this program and just being mad enough. Say how I feel in front of your audience, as I have how many years?
Coming up on 10.
Coming up on 10, that's exactly right. And let's just hope our president can assert himself in the proper way that he can overcome some of the idiots who are going to follow him, like Rubio and Rand.
Jeez.
I just can't imagine what Rand is going to say.
No, it's going to take Bottled in Bond to get me through Rand Paul.
Well, I'll tell you one thing about Rand. I don't know who does his hair or whether he puts it under a Van de Graaff generator or what, but it's just absolutely ridiculous. Just as ridiculous as his namesake.
Only his hairdresser knows, Jim. You have a good night.
Likewise. You too.
Bye now. Our old buddy Jim. And that's it. Thanks, everybody, for continuing to contribute to keep February going. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thanks to the hardest-working people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and acact.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.
Rick Smith is next on The Horn.